There's a lot of spontaneous protesting that's going on, and it's looking for an outlet. And I think they finally realize, well, this could be a big one, and they're scared of it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my buddy George Conway to help explain all the illegal news to me, of which there is much every week. Hey, George, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Okay. I want to get right into Bolton because this is one of these issues where I'm like, George, I need you to explain to me what is happening because I'm trying to figure it out. On the face of it, right, Bolton looks like the third in a series of malicious, vindictive indictments from Donald Trump that includes James Comey, which we've talked a lot about on this show, that includes Tish James, which we've talked about a lot on this show. Unlike those other two, whose cases were brought in the Eastern District of Virginia, where they installed Lindsey Halligan and fired people who wouldn't prosecute them, Bolton was indicted in Maryland, and he's charged with 8 counts of transmission of national defense information and 10 counts of retention of national defense information. So this case feels a little different than the Comey and Tish James case. I saw you doing some tweets about it. Explain to me what's different about Bolton's case.
I mean, in a nutshell, the other two cases, the Comey and the James cases, look like bullshit from the get-go. I mean, you read the complaint and you say, the indictments, and you say, what? How does this make any sense? How is this consistent with the facts? What's the legal theory in the case of the Comey indictment? You can't get perjury out of the Q&A, the ambiguous moving around Q&A that Comey had with Senator Ted Cruz in September of 2020. And with respect to the James indictment, that's a very, very murky area of all these documents that you sign when you get a mortgage, of whether they're consistent with one another and what it means to have something be an investment property as opposed to a second home, because a lot of people buy second homes as, you know, partially as investments. And then you have the fact that have come out that indicate, according to the New York Times, that Tish James actually did reside in the residence at least part-time and didn't charge her niece or grandniece, I think it was, rent, which is consistent with the idea that it was a second home. And so if she signed something that said it was a second home, or somebody signed a power of attorney that said it was a second home, it's not clear that they can prove that's untrue beyond a reasonable doubt. The complaints look flimsy and they don't make any sense on their face. The difference with Bolton's is you can see what the charges are. You can see what their theory of the case is. And I think the best way to it, I mean, basically what the theory is Bolton went to work every day and he took notes, very copious notes that he typed up. Maybe he had legal, I don't know exactly how he did it. Maybe he dictated it. Maybe he typed it. I have to go back and see what the exact facts are, but he was like a pack rat for keeping information, a diary of every day, every moment of every day, everything he did while he was in the White House. And it's pretty clear from some of the emails, I'm assuming the government didn't make those up, that he was doing that with an eye toward writing a book when he left government. And that's not uncommon for public officials. They go to the government. They don't make as much money in the government, and they want to cash out when they leave, and they're going to have some interesting experience. And the public has a right to know. And it's a very common thing for public officials to write books about their year or two stints in the government in various positions. But the rub here was, obviously, he was exposed to national security secrets. And when he wrote the book, he had to submit the book to people in the government, who nonpartisan civil servants who vet books to make sure that no classified information is in a book written by a former official. And he went through that process and he got a letter from the civil servant who was doing the review, saying this, some of the stuff has to come out, but All the other stuff is okay. And then he got in a brouhaha because the White House didn't want the book to come out in 2020, the Trump White House. So they basically put their foot down and squashed the civil servant who wrote that letter and said, yeah, well, we got more problems with this. And they did it, you know, kind of willy-nilly with a, obviously with a political intent of Donald Trump didn't want to be embarrassed by the fact that the book portrays him as an utter buffoon. That was really the sensitivity to Trump about this. But what happens is that letter was his shield. The letter was saying, see, look, I follow the rules. I submitted the book for pre-publication and it was clean from, there's no classified information in the final copy per this civil servant. Now that letter actually ironically becomes the government's sword. And here's why. When you read this book, and I tried to read it 5 years ago. I bought it, the room where it happened. It's like 490 or 470 pages long with 100 pages of footnotes and an index, just incredibly detailed. This book, basically, it reads like somebody strung together a bunch of long memos about every fucking day they went into the White House and then lightly edited it. It is impenetrable in spots. That doesn't mean it's not interesting. It's got a lot of interesting detail in there. And I'm not being critical of Bolton. He was clearly viewing his role. And this is, I get this. He's a national security type. They study history. He was writing for the historians. He wanted people to, you know, to have all the detail in the future about what happened during his stint in the administration. So they could, you know, they would have his book as a resource. And it was kind of an anally retentive project. Problem. It's pretty clear that the government's theory, which is that he had all these memos of daily diaries that were extremely detailed, makes perfect sense. That's how you would write a book like this. And the problem for Bolton is that the letter written by the civil servant shows that there was some material that he used that he had typed up and sent to himself and sent to two people who were not authorized to receive them. That information, there was classified information in there. That's point one. Point two is what the government's going to do at trial, and this may not be a hard case for the government to try, is this is how I would do it. I've never tried a criminal case, but I tried a lot of civil cases. You're going to line up these unbelievably turgid diary entries and extensive diary entries against the book. You know, take a few key events. And if there's interesting shit in the diaries that didn't get into the books, you're going to wonder, well, why did this anally retentive guy not put that in the book? And the answer may well be, wow, that's pretty sensitive. In which case, yeah, that means the diaries that he kept at home and that he put in his Gmail and that, I guess, according to the indictment, hacked by the Iranians, had classified or NDI information, not national defense information, that was of some sensitivity. And there you go. You have basically the charges similar to what Trump was indicted for, except...
Can I just make sure I understand? Because it sounds like what you're saying is the stuff that wasn't included in the book, right, is the part that he's going to get in trouble for because he had it in his notes at home, but it's not in the book.
Right. And if it's not there, why would this guy not put it in there?
So you mean he knew? Is that your point that then he knew it was too sensitive?
Right. I mean, again, we don't know. We don't have the diary entries. We have the book. And we may never see the diary entries because if it really does contain classified information, that's not going to be put out on the public record during a trial. But anyway, if in fact there's stuff in there that he left out and it's really kind of interesting stuff and it's national defense information, we're going to assume, it's not hard to draw the conclusion that Bolton realized, I can't put that in the book. But there you go. That's one level. But the other level of it is that the civil servant I talked about made him take some stuff out. And that stuff was probably in those notes. And he retained those notes. Again, these are making assumptions about the facts will be true, will come out to be true or not. I mean, this is what's going to, so in other words, whether or not there's a case against John Bolton depends on what's in this, what he actually transmitted to himself. And we need to see what that is. Now, that doesn't mean that this isn't a vindictive prosecution in the sense that maybe Donald Trump pushed this in a way that it would not have otherwise been brought, although the investigation started during the Biden administration. And unlike the Letitia James and the James Comey indictments, a bunch of people, it didn't prompt these mass refusals to work on the case. You got a bunch of lawyers signing the case. And from what I hear, they're pretty responsible. So this case is different. There is something here. He may have a problem. It's too early to judge, but you cannot. You have to separate this one out from the James and Comey cases. Now, he may have a selective prosecution defense. I don't know. But people have been prosecuted for a lot less. I mean, there's an analogy here to the Petraeus situation where he had this girlfriend who was writing a book and he sent some stuff, interesting stuff to her. And then he ended up having to plead to a misdemeanor, not these felony counts like the ones that Trump was charged with. But I want to go back to the one main point I want to make about this, which is the one a TV hit point that I would make first is these are serious charges and they demonstrate why Donald Trump should be in prison today. Because if this guy is being charged for this, and Donald Trump, who had actual classified documents up the wazoo, tons and boxes, and he hid them from the government and lied about it and tried to have videotape destroyed, obstructed justice on top of these, retaining on top of taking unauthorized taking of NDI and refusing to give it back. I mean, it's worse. So all you're doing, Donald Trump, by indicting, getting Bolton indicted is reminding us why you're a criminal. So that's my take on Bolton. We're going to have to wait and see. I hope that John beats this, but I'm not willing to lay odds on it at this point.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple other things. So one, is it possible this case could be that even though it is a case that is winnable on its merits, that Donald Trump, by interfering or by there being a pattern of practice, malicious prosecution or vindictive prosecution, that it could get tossed on those grounds?
Anything's possible, but this is going to be hard. As we've talked about in the past, even in the James and Comey cases, it's going to be hard because these doctrines are very rarely invoked. Now, in the James and Comey cases, those cases are so weak that's actually, in addition to strengthening the argument that the cases should be dismissed on the merits, it also strengthens the notion that this is something no one else would have been charged for. But in this case, Donald Trump was charged with kind of similar things, right? He was charged with taking the actual classified documents. There are actually some allegations in the complaint that there are a couple of actual classified documents that he had in his possession. But it really doesn't matter whether you take the original documents or have the information transcribed in some other form, right? I mean, if you copy down a PowerPoint that is top sensitive, compartmentalize the information or whatever the phrase is, and you take that home, you violated the law. And if you don't give it back when you're asked for it, you violated the law again. And in this case, there's some argument the government has that's what happened here with those, with the material. I mean, what's the difference between writing something down and having the information in on a yellow pad, for example, and having the actual same text in its original printed form, or stuffing the document in your socks the way Sandy Berger did? Not much. I mean, because the information is the information is the information and is the information that matters. So Bolton has a problem. He may beat this. He may not. I do not know. I will not handicap it. I'm going to be agnostic on what the outcome is. But I think everybody needs to understand this case may be a case that could have been brought by reasonable prosecutors under a different administration. But we don't know. Again, it's early.
Let me ask you a different question. And so I remember when we were dealing with Trump's documents case, one of the things that weakened the public opinion around the severity of that case was the fact that both Joe Biden and Mike Pence, very shortly after the Trump indictment were also found to have top secret documents in their possession, which they shouldn't have had. Is Bolton in a different class of people? Because in my understanding, when they did that, right, they basically apologized and gave them back, right? But people showed up and tore Biden's, you know, Delaware house apart for them. Is what Bolton did here like the same?
I think the government's going to be arguing. I mean, obviously, the defense is going to be arguing it's the same. But the government is going to be able to argue, assuming the facts are, as I think they may be, or at least they resemble what's in the indictment. I think the government's position is going to be, well, this is worse. And again, this is not something they have to prove to trial, but it will be relevant to any question of selective and unfair prosecution. It's like, look, he's got these. He retained these diaries specifically to retain that information. He deliberately chose the information he brought with it. It wasn't like, oh, there was a whole pile of documents and there were a few classified documents mixed in with them, and it just sort of got lost in the shuffle when we were transitioning out of this office and moving to private sector, and his personal papers got there were some, you know, there were some classified documents mixed in with all the other non-classified stuff. And yeah, that's how it ended up next to the Corvette, right? It's, you know, the intentionality they're going to argue is different because these, you know, and there are some emails saying, why are we using encryption? Somebody asked Bolton. It's like, well, you know, we don't want to tell anybody or something. There's some stuff in there that suggests that maybe the government's distorting it, that he knew he was taking sensitive information. You know, he wanted that information because he wanted to have a thorough record for him to cull out things that he could put in his book in a very anal retentive way. And it's a different form of intent. Joe Biden wasn't thinking like that. If you listen to Donald Trump, Joe Biden wouldn't be capable of thinking like that. And Mike Pence, you know, and again, they just turned the stuff over. And what happened here, there's an interesting factor, Winkle, is the way the government found out about this was, it was during the Biden administration when this investigation started. And apparently Bolton was hacked. And Bolton notified the government that he was hacked. And he was hacked, I guess, by the Iranians. The government tracked down some of the stuff. And they realized, oh, he's got some of these diary entries or the stuff that was hacked has classified information in it. Later, I think it was part of the book review process. I think he was required to give back anything that he had. And if he kept these notes and they were found at this search warrant, you know, it's sort of arguably like Trump. Again, I mean, you know, I don't know. We're going to learn a lot more about the facts as life goes on, except we may not actually learn the specific content of some of these, of some of this classified information that was in the notes or the diary entries, because there's a statute called the Classified Information Protection Act that governs how this stuff can be introduced in a court of law when it's needed to prove an espionage or a leak case.
And just as a final question before we move on from Bolton, if somebody's found guilty of something like this, is it the kind of thing that is you get a slap on the wrist, you get 6 months probation, or is it the kind of thing you go to jail for a long time?
I mean, Petraeus was pled down to a misdemeanor, right? And he didn't go to jail. It was really bad for him. And I think the Sandy Berger actually stuffed the document in a sock. I don't think he was pled to a felony. If not, he didn't go to jail for a very long time. I don't remember what it was. But this one, you know, Donald Trump was charged with violations of the Espionage Act, and Bolton was charged with those basically violating, I think, the same statutes, where basically it says it's not really defined in terms of classified information, but if you take sensitive national defense information with you, you know, that's one potential crime. And then if you don't give it back when you are asked for it by the government, that's another crime. And those are 10-year, potentially up to 10 years, each of those counts. I mean, you know, so this is a real case, and this is a scary case.
Yeah, I'm just going to guess I offer as a political matter, because here's the thing. I think we should have really high standards around our national security information. Like, I think that whether you're writing a book or whether you want to keep it in your bathroom because you just don't want anybody else to have it, you shouldn't be allowed to do that. and we have these rules in place for a reason. I gotta say, there is something deeply ironic about Donald Trump getting to be president again and doing this, and John Bolton going to jail for 10 years. I don't know if there's a second bite at the education apple around what Trump was doing and how, like, and this is the other thing, like, okay, so we've got Pete Hegseth, you know, with a signal chain. Like, the fact that John Bolton was hacked, Donald Trump is sending DMs on his, like, janky Truth Social platform that telling Pam Bondi to fire people. Like, their OPSEC is not clean. Their OPSEC is very dirty. Our foreign adversaries have more information about what America is doing now than they could possibly have hoped to have obtained in previous times. We are a sloppy, sloppy country around this. And so there just is something about, like, I think we should take this all very seriously, but it would be the worst kind of irony if Pete Hegseth gets to keep running, what is it, the Department of War or whatever he's cosplaying at, and Donald Trump gets to be president and Bolton goes to jail.
I thoroughly agree with that. And I think there, you know, I think there's a grotesque unfairness too, that Trump gets to walk because he drew a lucky, he made a lucky draw in terms of the judge he got. How would I put this? The charge is, oh yeah, with respect to Hegseth and that former NSA guy and the signal chains, I think a pretty strong argument can be made that if you charge Bolton, you should be charging Hegseth and company, because they were sending, you know, I think Hegseth was sending stuff to his wife. I don't know. I mean, they were sending stuff outside government authorized channels. And there's no question that was sensitive national defense information. For crying out loud, it's like it basically had the plans for imminent airstrikes, which, you know, potentially if that information fell into the hands of, say, the Iranians hacking, it could have been could have caused great harm to the people who are conducting the airstrikes. There's a lot of inconsistency here. And I agree with you that we have to have tough standards on this. And I think maybe it should be time to take a good look at what former officials do when they write these diaries or write these memos to themselves or do drafts, because that all potentially, even if it's coming from your brain and your recollection from 6 months ago or 6 hours ago or whatever it is, and you remember something top secret that you were told and you put it down on a piece of paper, that is something that belongs to the government effectively. So, you know, I mean, but that's one of the points that people are making, is like, well, you could get a lot of former public officials doing this, right? Because that's why they have a pre-publication process and the stuff gets taken out. And if you got drafts of it, well, that's NDI. You could be charged for that, maybe. So it's very, very tricky. And the problem is that there's a coherent theory and it makes some factual sense of what Bolton is being charged with. It may not be fair because some other people got away with stuff and this is the way people write memoirs. But from a legal standpoint, this could very well be proven to be a crime.
Yeah. And the very last irony I'll note is that this was the book that John Bolton chose to write instead of testifying.
He is the guy who basically decided not to take out the leopard with his book by writing this book, and he didn't testify. And now he's getting his face ripped off.
This show is sponsored by OneSkin, our friends over at OneSkin. If you've noticed more hair in your brush lately, you are not imagining it. Seasonal shedding and breakage ramps up when it starts to get cooler and drier outside. Trust me, I see it too. But OneSkin's OS1 hair can help. It's a scalp serum powered by their patented OS1 peptide, and it works by targeting the cells in your hair follicles that contribute to shedding, thinning, and slower hair growth. OneSkin is a big part of both my skincare and hair care routine, and OS1 hair can actually reactivate the hair growth cycle and promote thicker, fuller, denser hair, which is great for me because I'm recording videos all day. One thing it doesn't do is get rid of these new grays, though, which, I don't know what to do about.
Don't tell them about that.
They've done clinical studies on this serum to validate the science, and the numbers are pretty wild. 6 months in, people saw a 43% increase in hair thickness and 40% increase in hair density, in addition to seeing an overall reduction in hair shedding and increased hair volume and fullness. People are really seeing a difference with this hair serum. Born from over 10 years of longevity research, OneSkin's OS1 peptide is proven to target the cells that cause the visible signs of aging. So your scalp and your hair stay healthy as you age. Go to oneskin.co/hair and use code askgeorge for 15% off your first order. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Tell OneSkin that we sent you. Thanks, OneSkin. Turning now to this Chamber of Commerce lawsuit, which I myself am pretty interested in. This was some good news this week, which we don't always get. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce sued the administration, and I want to read from the complaint to explain what's at issue. For more than 70 years, what is now known as the H-1B visa program has enabled the United States to harness the magnetic draw of attracting the brightest talent from across the globe. Tens of thousands of highly skilled people in specialized fields boost the American economy each year after obtaining H-1B status. These workers allow businesses of all sizes and industries across the economy to innovate and grow. The resulting innovations lead to more American jobs, higher wages, and new products and services that improve the quality of life for all Americans. The H-1B program is a creature of statute, which Congress has meticulously maintained and modified over decades. The goal from the start has been to maximize the benefits of the program for the American people while also ensuring that American workers do not face a competitive disadvantage in the national workforce. The presidential proclamation at issue in this action upends that carefully crafted congressional balance. The centerpiece of the proclamation is the imposition of a $100,000 fee on all new petitions filed by United States employers intending to hire foreign workers through the H-1B program. By comparison, prior to the proclamation, most H-1B petitions cost less than $3,600. The proclamation is not only misguided policy, it is plainly unlawful. The president has significant authority over the entry of non-citizens into the United States, but that authority is bounded by statute and cannot directly contradict laws passed by Congress. It's a lot to read, but George, after seeing so many businesses cave or preemptively capitulate to the administration, it is nice to see the business community stand up to the administration in this instance. But the question is, do you think the chamber could ultimately prevail in this case?
The answer is I don't know. I thoroughly agree with the policy points being made by the chamber. I mean, and Donald Trump, of all people, should agree with the policy points being made by the chamber, because he was the one who originally complained that Mexico wasn't sending us their best. The H-1B program is the program by which we siphon off the best from people all over the world. And if anything, it has all the benefits that the chamber describes in the complaint. I mean, if you are taking the view that we want people to send us their best, we don't want them to send us their worst, you should be expanding the H-1B program, not making it more difficult for employers to bring people over. And there's some great stuff in the complaint about how, there's venture capitalists saying, we do these startup companies, we need these people, but we have to pay $100,000 a pop, we're not going to get them. It doesn't make any economic sense. And this is bad. Absolutely bad for America. I mean, these people can create jobs. They create jobs because they advance our ability to compete in highly technological fields. And that creates growth in business and jobs and productivity. So, and they're not taking American jobs away by definition, because that's the nature of the program, is you are seeking skilled labor that you cannot get in the United States. So, but the problem is, the statute. Okay, the statute does not set the fees. Okay? The fees are set by regulation. All the statute says, the statute that the chamber is relying on in its complaint says, is that the government may charge fees to cover its costs. So the inference that the chamber wants to draw is, okay, the government may charge fees to cover its costs, I'm oversimplifying the language, means that it can't charge fees for any other purpose or charge fees in excess of its costs. and the fees have to be reasonable. And that's buttressed by the fact that Congress wants this program to work, and Congress wants there to be H-1B visa applicants admitted to the United States. The problem is the text doesn't say may charge this and no more. Cannot charge more than. There are about 50 ways to write that statute to basically say to cap the fees very specifically at cost. And the statute doesn't use that language. There's some good legislative history if the chamber is quoting it correctly, helps. But it's an ambiguous, it looks to me to be an ambiguous statute. I would like to see I'd like to see what the government's response is, and I'd like to see what the chamber's reply to the government's response is on the legal theories. I'm sure we'll see that soon enough. And I'm not an administrative law maven. I mean, maybe they can get this as arbitrary and capricious as well, that they just pick these numbers to stymie the statute, and it's arbitrary and capricious under the Administrative Procedure Act. Yeah, who knows? But I just think it's too early to. I wasn't overwhelmed by the legal theory in the chamber's complaint, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some ad law maven would say, oh, yeah, this is a great complaint.
Yeah, I mean, I got to just talk about the politics of this for 1 second, because it is so weird to me that they have decided to go after the H-1B visas. And in fact, when Trump was in the All In podcast with the tech bros at one point, these are a lot of friends of Elon, you know, he walked away saying, yeah, anybody who graduates from an American university, they should have their H-1B visa, stapled to their diploma. Why is the Chamber of Commerce should not be the lone voice in here? Because what happens is, and this goes to a broader problem we are having with the Trump administration, which is the overall brain drain in America, like the cuts to NIH funding, like so many of the DOGE cuts, they attack places where we were providing the kinds of grants and opportunities for medical research and other innovation that kept the smartest people from China and the smartest people from Greece and the smartest people from all over the world would come to America to figure out how to invent things and to start businesses because we had the best environment for that. And those people are leaving. They're going to go to China. They're going to go to Russia. They're going to go to other places that are going to attract them. And so I just don't understand why he's doing this. Like you could be like, well, you know, you're going to make more money. Like he's trying to, the way he tries to wring money out of everything. And he's like, well, I'll just charge them more without realizing people aren't going to pay that. They will go somewhere else. So like, what is the point of this? Do you know?
Look, I mean, it's not rational. Okay. The whole attack on immigration is xenophobia. And xenophobia is a classic characteristic of fascist authoritarian movements. But another classic aspect of authoritarian and fascist movements is anti-intellectualism. They're against smart people who read books and do things. That's, you know, a whole attack on science that we're seeing at the universities, at the CDC, at the NIH. It's all, you know, there's just this urge to take out the smart people, to take out the people who are hoity-toity, who they think look down on the people who vote for the fascist authoritarian. And, you know, it's part of the way that an authoritarian likes to divide people. And I think that's really what explains this as much as anything else. It's not designed to serve any economic purpose. It is designed to basically play to people's prejudices and to be anti-intellectual.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's much more to say about it than that, because I think that's right. I do want to get to the National Guard, but first, fall is here, and you know what that means. The temps are dropping, but your kitchen's heating up. It's game day spreads, slow-simmered stews, and comfort food on repeat. And if your current hands flinch every time they see high heat, you deserve better. Enter HexClad, the cookware that's as serious about performance as you are about that meat thermometer. Are you super serious about your meat thermometer? No.
I just tell the waiter medium and it comes back,
the right way.
That's my thermometer.
Got it. This isn't your grandma's nonstick. Hexclad pants give you that perfect sear, crazy durability, and easy cleanup without babying your cookware. Stainless steel strength, toxin-free, nonstick convenience, and yeah, they look damn good sitting on my stovetop. These have been a huge upgrade to the cookware we use around my house. This stuff is built for the long haul. And anybody who listens to me knows I'm not a big cook, but other people in my family are. And I will say, these pans, they look great. And most importantly, I love their handles don't get hot, because I am a classic, oh, I'm just going to move this and like burn my hand all the time. Now, let's not forget about the real game changers here. Hexclad 6-piece and 12-piece sets take the guesswork out of cooking. Whether you're starting fresh or leveling up, these bundles cover every dish, every craving, every crowd. It's the kind of upgrade that transforms your kitchen from good enough to how did I ever cook without this? Plus, every Hexclad product is backed by a lifetime warranty. You're not just investing in better tools, you're setting the tone for seasons of cooking to come. Game days are here. It's time to upgrade your kitchen for hosting season. Get 10% off at hexclad.com/askgeorge and make sure your spread is as strong as your lineup. Support the show and cook with gear as serious as your passion at hexclad.com/askgeorge. Let Hexclad know we sent you and experience the ultimate upgrade in your kitchen with Hexclad's superior performance. Thanks, Hexclad. All right, George, now I want to talk about the National Guard. So last week we talked about the district court order staying the deployment of the National Guard in Chicago. And this week, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the stay. Trump argued that deploying the Guard was necessary to quell violent assaults against federal immigration agents and property. But the Seventh Circuit wrote, political opposition is not rebellion. A protest does not become a rebellion merely because the protesters advocate for myriad legal or policy changes, are well organized, call for significant changes to the structure of the U.S. government, use civil disobedience as a form of protest, or exercise their Second Amendment right to carry firearms as the law currently allows. Nor does a protest become a rebellion merely because of sporadic and isolated incidents of unlawful activity or even violence committed by rogue participants in the protest. Such conduct exceeds the scope of the First Amendment, of course, and law enforcement has apprehended the perpetrators accordingly. But because rebellions at least use deliberate, organized violence to resist government authority, the problematic incidents in this record clearly fall within the considerable daylight between protected speech and rebellion. That seems like really important framing by the Seventh Circuit, because this administration's strategy is to say there isn't any daylight between protected speech and rebellion. For them, it's like a light switch, right? It's like how they construe all opposition as rebellion or domestic terrorism. What did you think about this opinion, and where do you think this case is headed next?
I think it's a great opinion. I don't know whether this one or some other case is going to be headed to the Supreme Court, but I think the Seventh Circuit case, the district court opinion as well, I mean, they're very, very powerful. And I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, we've talked about this statute several times, Section 12406, and what the requirements are. And it has to be, you know, insurrection or rebellion, or the president being unable to enforce, to execute the laws with the regular forces. And none of those things has been shown. And I think the only way you can get to a contrary result is to do, I guess the Ninth Circuit's still sitting on this, is to think of the case the way one of the Ninth Circuit judges that heard the panel appeal from Oregon was saying that the president has to decide how to allocate resources. But the fact of the matter is, the president's ability to allocate resources is determined by this statute, and this statute has very specific requirements for the federalization of the National Guard, and any suggestion, I mean, the judge in the Northern District of Illinois in Chicago said, the federal judge said, you know, this is just, it doesn't compute, it just does not make any sense. And as I've been saying, it's all pretextual. It's pretextual, and it's designed as also to be performative, to show people they're being strong. And it's also designed, and the district court was very good about this in Chicago, it is designed to provoke. She basically said I mean, she didn't say it quite as sharply as I did, but she basically said that the only people who are causing trouble here is the government. They're provoking people. And that's, you know, that's happened throughout history. It's one of the things that happens. And then the government uses it to justify more repression. And that's kind of what's been happening here. And, you know, I think it's important that when people go out there to protest, like they will be doing tomorrow, I will be doing, Clyde will be doing tomorrow.
I will be doing.
We'll be doing. Okay, we'll have to coordinate. We have to, you know, like don't fall for the provocations. Don't fall for the provocations.
Can I ask you just... So yes, be peaceful, but do go out, do show up. This is really an important one right now. I think I got to ask you though, George, have you been surprised? As again, just me veering into politics quickly. Have you been surprised to hear Mike Johnson and so many other Republicans? I mean, Carolyn Leavitt said yesterday. I mean, they're saying it's a hate America rally where people are they're Hamas and it's terrorists. I don't know, not that far away from when everybody was talking about the Charlie Kirk murder and how irresponsible the rhetoric was to call them fascists and everything. And now they're just talking about a bunch of people who are going to go out who've been calling for a peaceful protest. It's organized. And they are saying it's a hate America rally conducted by Hamas and terrorists. That seems incendiary, insane, false, and designed, as you say. It's not even provoking. It's like, they're trying to frame this from the jump. Like if they're saying right now they're bombing these boats in Venezuela, right? These drug boats, and they're saying that they are allowed to do that, that it's legal because they're terrorists. So if they call those of us going to these protests terrorists, is that not their attempt to say that they have every reason to crack down on us? Like, what is happening here?
A couple of things. One is they're scared of this. They realize there's something afoot that's going on that they can't necessarily control. And it's kind of like the, you know, they've been worried, for example, about these town halls that they've decided not to hold. There's a lot of spontaneous protesting that's going on, and it's looking for an outlet. And I think they finally realize, well, this could be a big one, and they're scared of it. And I agree with you. They're trying to frame it in advance. They're trying to do at least two things. One is, they're trying to trying to win a propaganda battle to make people think who are not paying a lot of attention. Make those people think that these are bad, that they're at war with these bad people who are these bad lefty communist Antifa people who are marching in the streets. And the second thing that they're trying to do is they're trying to scare people from coming out. You know, people that they're trying to basically show, oh, this is going to be dangerous, both by suggesting that the people who are marching are dangerous, but by implicitly suggesting that there may have to be some law enforcement response. So they're trying to create fear of these rallies, both among people who are sitting at home watching Fox News or Newsmax, but also for people who might otherwise come out. And I think it's just important to message this, that look at all the other events that have been held. Look at what's going on in Portland. I mean, it's all, you know, I mean, people dressing up in frogs, dancing, singing Sweet Caroline and such. You know, this is not your Antifa protest. Okay. Whatever. And Antifa doesn't even really exist. This is homegrown, you know, and this isn't Soros paying for it. These are real people who basically, you know, who are realizing they got to do something. And the organizers are hopeful that this is going to be the largest protest in American history. And I'm willing to bet money that it will be.
This is something that I care about. What do you make of the IRS stuff? I know this wasn't something we talked about, but I do want to know, do you have an opinion on the way that Trump is going after people's nonprofit status and the way they're weaponizing the IRS?
I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, their object is to use every lever of power, legally or illegally, to leverage against people who oppose them or are perceived as opposing them. Doesn't matter whether these involve criminal violations of law, because it's criminal to tell the IRS to investigate somebody for political reasons. There are criminal prohibitions that Congress enacted in the wake of the Watergate scandal to prevent this. Now, I mean, there's obviously Trump may be immune thanks to the Supreme Court. A lot of other people aren't. They want to scare everybody from coming out. They want to scare people from starting nonprofits. They want to scare people from doing things that they don't like. And they're going to use every method at their disposal, even if it's a violation of the criminal law. They'll do it. They don't care.
Before I wrap, I want to ask about the Supreme Court, because we talked a lot today about district and appellate courts blocking the administration from unlawful actions. But the Supreme Court term just kicked off. And most of these cases will eventually make their way up to the Supreme Court. Is it naive to take comfort in these lower court wins when the Supreme Court is going to is probably going to side with this administration more often than not?
I'm concerned about whether the Supreme Court actually gets what its proper role is here. And I don't like the way it's been handling some stuff. I just don't know how it's going to come out. But at the end of the day, it has always been my position, and you've heard me say this for several months, that the courts will not save us. Because either the court goes your way, the Supreme Court goes your way, and at a certain point, then the government's going to say, screw it, we're not going to obey the Supreme Court. You know, again, what matters is people coming out and showing their support for democracy. And maybe that'll put some spine in the Supreme Court, I don't know. But we are the ones we are waiting for. And it's not going to be John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh and Alito and Thomas.
George, as always, thanks for talking about the illegal news with me. Guys, thanks for listening to another episode of George Conway Explains It All. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and we will see you next week. Have a good No Kings weekend, guys.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, God. And close.